I've changed the title a little bit, but it's basically the same. So this is indeed going to focus more on X-ray results. You heard from Peter the other day with a very nice summary of what sorts of optical HST analyses we're doing on these systems. I'm going to focus here mostly on two clusters, 47TUC and 6397, because A, we've got beautiful data on them, which is still far from fully analyzed. I'm going to show you in a brief sort of snapshot mode the new data, which we've just gotten in the last couple months on 47TUC. I think many here may have heard that we've got a very deep observation and the results are quite spectacular. Lots of new sources, which are going to take, needless to say, some time to fully digest, but we'll get to those. So it'll be primarily on these two clusters. And one of the major goals that I have here, is this pointer working or shall I use the, I guess we'll use this thing, is to eventually try to extract from these two clusters, and of course ultimately from many more, something about the neutron star white dwarf content of these clusters. I've been mumbling about this, or about globulars in general. I've been mentioning this in a number of our discussions in the last few days. I think, provided that we believe, and this is of course maybe a good avenue for discussion here, that to first order at least, the capture processes, whether they be some version of a tidal capture or an exchange collision, are going to be relatively comparable in efficiency for the two, then with enough source distributions, ultimately from these clusters and others, but these 47TUC in particular, of course, with such a large number of sources, really wins on the statistics question. We might, or I hope we will ultimately learn something about this very interesting question, which would presumably tell us something about not only neutron star retention that we heard about from Eric yesterday, but perhaps the initial mass function. So those are some of the goals of this work. As I said, these two clusters are going to be the main emphasis here. I will spend a little bit of time talking about the millisecond pulsars in 47TUC, although this has been published last month, so those who are interested have hopefully read this, but for those who haven't, I'll go over some of the results here. A few words at the end about the possibilities of binary ejection, or at least rather pronounced scattering, shall we say, which I think we're seeing direct evidence for. I thought I'd start with a summary table, which I hope is complete. I think it's at least got everybody listed. I'm not absolutely sure about all of these numbers. These were basically from memory. I didn't look everything up here. That gives you the story, which has not changed for the last 2 years since Nick White and Laura Angelini found a second source in M15. So it's been the same story for a good long while. We've got 12 clusters in the galaxy that contain what those of us in the trade here, and I suspect everyone in the room pretty much, know as low-mass X-ray binaries. These are LMXBs. These things differ in that at one time or another, all of these guys are observed to be bright, persistent sources. But if you read through the numbers in this table, you can see that a good many of them have got a range of luminosities, roughly half of the 12. So one of the first things to keep in mind, for those who don't look at these numbers that often, is that these sources are indeed highly variable. And when we're talking about the quiescent LMXB population, the QLMXBs, they are, of course, very closely connected with this whole population. They're the same things. The only difference is that they, ones that we're seeing now in great numbers, well, significant numbers at least, in a number of clusters, many groups, number of groups involved with this, are not on this table because they've never been seen in a high luminosity phase. At some point or other, they presumably must. I think we're going to hear more about that from Bob Rutledge and a much more complete discussion of these systems. I will touch only on the systems in 47TUC here. So the main thing I wanted you to notice is that the clusters, the 12 clusters here, 2 and M15, they're of course, just as one quick aside on this, looking so unusual to have two that are now currently bright, lots of clusters have got more than one QLMXB, 6652, right here has got four, tourism five, and I'm going to show you some results of that we have just finished. Craig Heinke has done a very nice job looking at an image that I'll show you, which is a terrible Chandra image because the bloody source went off and outburst at the time. It wasn't supposed to, but this is exactly what can happen here when these things are transient half of the time. But despite that, we can still see five quiescent LMXBs in that cluster alone. So at some time or other, Tirzan 5 is probably blazing away with a couple of these things at once. But typically, there's just one on at any one time. What I was going to point to here, though, are some of the cluster properties. Since we're not only talking about compact objects, we're talking about the clusters that they live in and where they come from. So it's interesting just to scan these numbers. Again, they'll be familiar to many here. They're typically all high-density clusters, but of course there are the notable exceptions that we've been talking about for decades now, 6712, Tirzan 2 is a high-density cluster. 6712, in the last few years, Guido and colleagues have done a very nice job showing that this cluster is indeed, as some of us had suggested long ago, in the process of disruption or something very similar to that. So it presumably was much higher density in the past. Not clear what's going on with Tirzan 1, or for that matter with most of these Tirzan clusters. They're so heavily reddened that they're typically very poorly studied. And some of the numbers over here for those clusters, like the metallicities, are uncertain at best, but in general they are certainly very metal-rich, amongst the most metal-rich ones in the galaxy. Lillar 1 here, I think, does still hold the record as the most metal-rich cluster. So one thing that's come up in the last couple days is, and I'll get to in the end in this discussion of neutron stars versus white dwarfs, is this question here, whether the incidence of high luminosity systems, or to the extent that having a system on at any one time colors that cluster red or some other color from the other 90% of the clusters in the galaxy, is there anything unusual about these clusters, apart from them all generally having high central density? Well, they generally do have high metallicity. In fact, there's only one really good exception to that, and of course it's a fairly remarkable one, it's M15. The rest of them, if you look at what little you can do when you've only got 12 balls to drop into a distribution, they are on the metal-rich side of the cluster distribution in the galaxy. If you make a similar sort of just histogram plot here of the central density, it looks as if, although this is hardly very convincing statistically, but it looks as if there is more of a peaked distribution here in metallicity. They're more preferentially metal-rich than they are all, at least in the sample that we're looking at, high central density, or at least the two in the tail here are contributing to that. Well, here, in fact, is the image of Tirzan 5 that I just mentioned. I wanted to show this to introduce the point that these clusters, the 12 we've just been looking at, are the ones that have a bright LMXB on at any one time, but the separate population that we found years ago, back originally with Einstein and been worked on, of course, over the last 20 years with ROSAT and now much more successfully with Chandra, the population of dim sources, the faint sources, here you see the nine that I mentioned in this rather muddy-looking reproduced image here, in Tirzan 5, which, given this searchlight that you're looking against, this blinding glare of this thing, which was at about 10 to the 36 when we got these data, meant that the 50 kiloseconds in this exposure were not very sensitive. The remarkable Chandra PSF isn't that remarkable when you've got a factor of 10 to the 3 dynamic range between here and here. So the luminosity limit here was down pushing 10 to the 32, 10 to the 32.2, I'm not going to take the time or have the time to talk about the sources here in detail. There's a paper that Craig is just finishing. It's about to go back into the journal from the referee that points out rather convincingly, I think, that, as I mentioned, five of these sources are QLMXBs. They have the characteristic soft black body-like spectra, thermal spectra. And four are power law, much harder spectra, and look very much like CVs. There's a follow-up observation that Rudy Winans is doing that we're involved with that will hopefully not have the same good luck or poor luck here that this thing was as bright as it was. So let's go to 47 Tuck. This is an image that I think Peter showed, and it's been shown a number of times, the combined optical versus Chandra color image of the center of the cluster from the data taken back 2 years ago, nearly 3 years ago now, shown in the usual, or now becoming usual, color representation in three bands. This was ACES-I data. What I'm going to show you in a bit here is the new data, which was taken with ACES-S, and for those who are not Chandra aficionados, the principal difference, the reason we wanted to go for this very deep look with ACES-S was to get the improved low-energy soft sensitivity. That was due in large part to the fact that what we found in this image that I'll show you in just a minute here, and that probably most of you have seen, was a remarkable distribution of very soft sources that we wanted to measure their spectra or colors at least much more convincingly than we could do here. We didn't do ACES-S in the first go-around back in the early days of Chandra because we were nervous about backgrounds, as many were at the early stage, which looked as if it would be higher, and in some cases is higher. So this has all been published a couple of years ago, so it's something that probably most have seen. The 100 plus sources in that central part of the image, that box that was on the last chart there, is just the central 2 arc minutes. It contains about 108 sources. I think the actual numbers were that 103 or 104 of those were convincingly detected with wave detect algorithm that most here are using, I'm sure. There were 3 or 4 others that were very marginal, and you would have no reason to believe, except that in 4 of those cases, they were positionally coincident with millisecond pulsars. In one case, at the remarkably high statistics level of 1 count, which I'm sure those who have looked at this have been amused by, as we were, but it turns out to be correct. Not that we really questioned it, because it was on a chip gap, as we said in this paper. It had every reason to be lower in flux. Of course, there is a luminosity distribution for those millisecond pulsars that we'll get to. So the 100-odd sources in the original data are distributed like this. We heard about luminosity functions from Dave. Here's the 47 Tuck luminosity function, which does look, to the extent one can describe something over a couple orders of magnitude here, like a power law distribution. It is composed, as we were discussing the other day, of a variety of different sources. So one could argue this is an interesting accident of nature that these three different source groups, the millisecond pulsars, the CVs, and these amusing and becoming increasingly obviously important in this cluster and probably a number of others, main sequence binaries, so-called BY Draconis systems. I will be the first to admit that before we got these data and started really digging into it, I'd never heard of a BY Draconis system. I'll bet, I won't ask for a show of hands. I'm sure Ivan knew all about these, but most of us didn't. They are, for those who still haven't heard about them, the main sequence analogs of RS Canvan systems, which at least in the X-ray world are more familiar because they're more luminous systems. These are typically more main sequence binaries, although I'm going to show you at the end that there are some of these that border in an interesting way on the RS Canvan or some other population of having a non-main sequence member of the binary. But they're there as X-ray sources down at these low luminosities, typically around 10 to the 30. They're down mostly at the bottom of this distribution, competing with the millisecond pulsars, which is where they all are piled up, down here in the bottom. This, of course, is just the threshold of the exposure, obviously. There's no reason to believe this is real. There must be some low luminosity turnover, but we haven't seen it in these data. In any case, main sequence binaries with typically half-day periods. And the two quiescent LMXBs, there may be a third one that Peter alluded to the other day. We'll know that for sure from the full treatment of the new data, which has not yet been finished. But the two that are shown here are these two systems that I'll show you again in an image, which are well studied now and which have, in fact, here are results summarized in this chart by Craig, have very beautiful fits to these hydrogen atmosphere or helium atmosphere. There really is no significant difference for either of these two sources. Models basically cooling thermal spectra from neutron stars in both cases, although with very interesting differences. And again, as I mentioned at the start, I wasn't going to talk about these systems in particular, given Bob's talk coming up and given all the other things I'm trying to cover, but they're very interesting differences for both of these systems, actually, which you'll see in this paper, which is probably going to be posted next week. It's gone back into the journal. Is it already on? Yes, good, okay. that there is evidence for winds or mass loss in both of these systems. They're both very luminous. You can see on the last chart, they're up at 10 to the 33 nearly. They're both cooking their companions. One of them, of course, has a very beautifully constrained binary orbit, 8.8 hours, and with the new data, we should be able to phase it up back with the old data. In fact, phase it up all the way back to ROSAT, look at Frank Verbund's old data, which ought to just about be able to see this thing in its binary or dip-like modulation. But in any case, these are dirty systems. And in the case of the one with eclipses, so that obviously very high inclination. So the total number is still with this original data set, 108 goes up to something pushing 200 when one goes further out. These are corrected for the still small numbers of background AGN, only at 4 arc minutes. It's still only half a dozen or so, not large. This was only, quote unquote, 70 kiloseconds, a bit more than that, 6 or so. but now with the additional analysis, somewhere in here, we're making a transition from what's been in the earlier papers to what is coming out now. The spectral analysis that Craig has been primarily doing is in conjunction or in complementarity, shall we say, to the work you heard about from Peter, the HST follow-up. We now have a total number of CVs in 47 Tuck that are roughly 30. The numbers are still not definite. These are all now identified on the basis of their X-ray spectra, 23 of which, or 22 of which, I guess I've written here, Peter can correct me, have optical counterparts with HST. So there are at least 22. There are very certainly 30, and I suspect even more. The new data show a few more interesting, hard, steady, relatively steady sources that will be strong contenders. So that's the current box score from the old data set. Here again is just the full image. And I'm showing this here, although I apologize, at least from here, this looks pretty murky, because in addition to everything we've just been talking about, which is probably, again, familiar to many at least, the three major classes of sources, the interacting binaries, the main thing we're interested in here, we were very interested in these data in the beginning because this remarkable result from our millisecond pulsar collaborators, Fernando Camillo in particular, who's played a key role in working with us on these data and will on the new data as well, they found, as again I think probably most here have long since heard, that the MSPs in 47 Tuck, of which there are 17 with known timing positions, have this remarkable variation of their dispersion measures across the cluster. I'll show you a chart in just a second here where they are relative to the cluster, allowing one to model the electron density in the cluster, giving rise to that variable dispersion measure, and giving then a constraint on the free gas in the cluster, the first really convincing detection of free gas in any globular cluster, one of the old problems going way, way back that's finally been cracked with this unexpected route at getting at it. And using that number for the inferred gas density, which is comparable to the local ISM, 0.1 or so, and just simple Bondi-Hoyle accretion theory, but with a big caveat that we never will really know what the efficiency of this accretion process is. There are all sorts of complications that would be fun to talk about here, but making the most plausible scalings, as you can see back in the original paper, this led to an upper limit of something like 500 solar masses on any central black hole, which ought to be in this roughly 3 arc second diameter circle, giving the positional uncertainty of the cluster center. I'm mentioning all this because in the new data, I'll show you in just a few minutes, this green source here, which is clearly the brightest source in the circle and which was giving rise to this upper limit, this is about 10 to the 31, is a very interesting object. I don't think it's a black hole. It's probably another of these BY Draconis systems, but it's a highly variable soft source. And certainly we're going to are working on what this thing really is. It's probably, as I say, one of these main sequence binaries. The pulsars, I'll go through this quickly because we've got to get to the new data here. I've already mentioned the statistics on detection here. The total numbers inferred from the primarily soft spectra or soft colors, these things are not spectra, these are typically 5 to 10 count sources, so just hardness ratios, gave rise to the numbers that I'll show you again in the next chart here. Here are the pulsar positions overplotted on the cluster, the 16 in this representation, precisely determined positions. Given that at those positions all are detected at some level, though as I mentioned, 4 of them are not real significant detections, but of the 9 or 10 that had reasonable hardness ratios constrained, some of them were as bright as 20, 30 counts, one could infer, as we did in this paper that's just out, that these things are very soft and that the underlying soft source population in the cluster is a reasonable constraint on the total MSP or millisecond pulsar population. So here are the radial projected cumulative distributions of the 17, I believe we actually had here, the 17th one came along, MSPs versus sampling, sorry, it is just 16 as I've said here, sampling 16 of the underlying soft sources that are not already identified with the pulsars, showing that they're statistically indistinguishable, and showing that the suggestion that Fred and others had made, and certainly it was a very interesting question to ask given that apparently truncated looking distribution of the 16 sources at something like 3.5 optical core radii, is not required by the data. At least if we assume that these soft sources are the much larger reservoir of MSPs that Fernando and others have suggested would have to be there, these show that they're not cut off, and in fact they're distributed with a nice thermal distribution with a mass ratio versus the background stars in the core, Q, of about 1.6, 1.7. So given that we saw numbers as high as 0.9 for 47 Tuck, we actually used 0.7 for the typical mass in the core. These things are up at very reasonable masses for these systems. So very quickly, because this has all come out, the pulsars themselves are an interesting population versus those in the field. You can see the ones in the field are not very well constrained in the way that Werner Becker and many others have been doing for years now. One likes to look at the pulsar efficiency, namely the luminosity coming off in X-rays, either thermal, as is the case with virtually all of these, or total luminosity, and in the case of the guy up on the top there, which in fact is in a globular cluster, M28, the only one on that whole distribution in the quote field here that's in a cluster and is primarily non-thermal, that luminosity scales normally linearly or close to linearly with the spin-down luminosity of the pulsar. These 47 Tuck guys do not. The exponent here on this log-log plot, which I guess I didn't write down, but this is all out, you can read this, is about 0.5 and suggests that these are systems, I guess let me just finish the remark here, that have been altered, at least possibly been altered. What we've suggested is that because these things are very old, we can infer, there isn't time to discuss, it's all in that paper, that these were probably formed in a burst early in the cluster history, and they've typically undergone 3 to as many as 10 encounters with other cluster members, rehardening the binaries and very likely undergoing renewed accretion episodes. So these things are MSPs that have gone back and forth into the LMXB domain. This is at least plausibly going to do something to the surface magnetic field, and in comparisons with the models that Alice Harding in particular have done, we were able to show that, or suggest, it hasn't been worked out by Alice or anyone else, that if the magnetic field geometry on the surface of the neutron star were dominated by multiple components, that won't affect the field at large distances where the radio emission is thought to come from, it'll be dipolar out there, that the thermal luminosity and the very tiny 100 meter sized effective black body like emitting areas that these luminosities correspond to might make sense. So this is an interesting way to get at the notion that these very old compact binaries are themselves being multiply recycled. Okay, the new data. I'm going to just scroll through the images here, these ACES-S images. This is what was done just a few months ago. We'll speed up here. And to compare with the old data, which we've been looking at all this time, here is the same smoothing on the ACES-I data. So these are the two bright QLMXBs. These images, let me warn you right now, as you look at your favorite source, if you have them, are not, the way I'm displaying them here, are not showing you the faintest sources in the cluster. In fact, some of the MSPs will appear in some of these images and some not in others, just the way the smoothing has been done. The 16 pulsars are all there, as I mentioned before, in all the images, showing no sign of variability. But here's the original data with the pulsar positions overplotted. Here was pulsar C up here, which was, you know, the one count guy on the chip gap in the original data. Now, with the first of the ACES-S exposures, there it is, quite clearly. Comparable exposure, but ACES-S, and if you can remember it, I'll toggle back and forth between a couple of these later on. There are many more sources in this data set. When we look at date, well, this is just showing the pulsar positions, the same error circles overplotted. When we look at day later, the pulsar didn't disappear, it's there. This is just the windowing of these images. They're just done quickly with an adaptive smoothing, simply to suppress all the background in the image. The source content is largely the same, but if we go through a couple more of these, here's 3 days later. The idea was to do 1, 3, and 10 day separations to be able to constrain binary periods in a large number of these systems. There are many sources that are turning on and turning off. I don't know how well you can see this from perhaps the first row even, but there are sources that you can see just coming and going all through the cluster here. So what have we been able to learn from this? The only thing I'm going to take the time, given the vanishing time, to show you is what I mentioned, that interesting source right near the cluster center. Here it is over the 10 days of data, showing this long-term variability, primarily soft emission, KEV emission. It doesn't look what I would have thought a black hole, an intermediate mass black hole, would look like. So I don't think this is what we're seeing at all. Probably, as I say, one of these active binaries. So let me quickly speed up then to compare with 6397. Comparing the properties of the two clusters here, which are familiar to most, I suspect, and now quickly go through what the initial Chandra data looked like, which, again, most will have seen. It's a very different looking cluster image from what we've just been looking at, dominated by CVs. That's the major difference. A few of these, I've skipped over one here, a few of the BY Draconis systems, here are the CVs, 1 millisecond pulsar, the radio pulsar, coincident with a system that we had thought, in fact, when we found it in the HST data, was one of these BY Draconis systems, showing how easily they can be confused. and one bona fide QLMXB, one thermal soft black body emitter, and the only one in the cluster. The new data, shown just for comparison here in the same way as what you just saw for 47 Tuck, here's the old data once again, just to guide your eye, as it were, smoothed in the same way. The CVs, there's the pulsar. I won't point, this is a CV. Mostly CVs, the one QLMXB up here. When we look at the sum of the two ACES-S exposures, it's basically the same. These two things, which are probably these active binaries, BY Draconis type systems, have turned on. One of the original bright ROSAT CVs, where we first identified these things and first made CV identifications with HST of these initial bright four, has clearly dimmed, but not remarkably, as I'm sure Brian would tell us. If you prefer to look at raw photon scatter plots instead of these smoothed images, you can see them here, and I suspect, again, you won't be able to see, but there are there are interesting, very faint sources here that are changing in brightness that are probably more of these active binaries out on this side of the cluster center. Okay, so let me quickly summarize here what is apparent from these data. I've mentioned most of these points already, that the one of the nine original CVs has clearly changed in brightness significantly, not surprising in its own right. The pulsar, actually, let me show you back in the data where it's labeled here. This system here, next to one of the CVs, if you look at our paper from a year ago, in fact, the first paper, we pointed out, and Peter actually showed this the other day in the HST color magnitude diagram, this thing looks to be, it's almost identical in its optical properties with the millisecond pulsar here. So it's either a BY Dracona system, I told you a minute ago that this thing was fooled us initially, or if one wanted to make the comparison just on its optical and in fact its lack of X-ray variability properties, it looks very similar to the MSP. So it's interesting that over the three moderately deep data sets now, that system has not changed. It gives it a slightly increased possibility of being something similar to the millisecond pulsar. We haven't demonstrated this, of course, there's no known pulsar at that position, but it's possible that the cluster contains another MSP here. The pulsar itself, the one known one, does show variability in the new data. There's marginal evidence for the same eclipse-like behavior we saw in the first data, but the phasing coverage of these observations was not optimum to fully map out the light curve. Let me finish very quickly.
Actually, Josh, why don't you leave this up and
let's
take Josh and we can do it.
Alrighty.
Okay, so any questions? Vicky? Wait for the mic, please.
This is the final chart, essentially, comparing these clusters and the number distribution, so we can talk about this. Okay.
You showed, Josh, how you looked at the X-ray luminosity for some of the millisecond pulsars, those that are known as radio pulsars, and compared it to E dot. Can you use that relationship and count how many other point X-ray sources would have a radio luminosity above the sensitivity limit of the radio pulsar observations, and use that number to say something about beaming fraction?
Yes, it's all in our paper.
Oops, okay.
But you're excused for asking, because I'm sure most people haven't read that, but we can say something about it, and the simplest way of interpreting those two sets of numbers, but there, as with all these arguments, there are other ways of answering the question, but the most straightforward way would say the beaming fraction is 20%.
Okay.
And you can do it in your head very roughly. We have roughly 100 objects that look from the Chandra data to be identical or at least indistinguishable from the known 15 or 16 or 17 actually radio located MSPs. Okay. That's the ratio right there, but there are other factors that go into this, of course, completeness factors primarily.
You talked about the X-ray constraints on a black hole in the center of this cluster.
Yes.
Are there any radio constraints on the luminosity of a radio point source in the center? Because given what we know about low luminosity AGN, that might be a better way to find a black hole in the center of a globular cluster.
We could ask one of our radio colleagues here if there are such constraints. I would be surprised that they would be very helpful in this regard, because this thing clearly, if there were something there and all we've done is set an upper limit on it, it's accreting at a very, very low rate. This is low even by the standards of Sag J star. But that's an interesting way to try to constrain it.
Well, there are some images with the Australia Telescope Compact Array that have tried to search for unassigned radio luminosity at the center of the cluster.
Right.
It's unassigned to known sources, and it's really a hard proposition. There's a faint, some faint radio luminosity there, but it cannot really be resolved.
So. And again, it's probably, or at least more plausibly, just the unresolved emission from all of these 100 odd
from other millisecond pulsars and so on. Yeah.
If one had spectra, one could.
So there's certainly nothing relatively strong there that you can see.
Brad?
Yep, Brad.
I just wanted to ask about the last line of your figure there, or your table there.
Yep.
Do I get that by basically dividing millisecond pulsar by CVs and by the relative mass fraction? Because I get a factor, there should be about a factor of six difference between the two, and there's only about two.
Well, maybe I've done the arithmetic wrong, but this is an attempt to get at just what I mentioned at the beginning was one of the things I'm interested in trying to extract from comparing these. The neutron star to white dwarf remnant numbers. And the reason why there's no gamma, no collision factor here is that, as I mentioned, if we assume that they have the same formation efficiencies, those would divide out. But what your point, Brad, was you're getting a different number from these
Working down, 90 versus 1, and then there's a factor of 10 the other way, and then there's a factor of 5 the other way. So I'm only getting...
Yeah, there's the factor of 5. Well, okay, we take 90 versus 30, there's a factor of 3. No. These are, maybe it's not clear, but these are ratios within a given cluster. The question here is what is the ratio, the relative efficiency of, for the same to first order formation processes, winding up with a white dwarf in one of these compact systems versus a neutron star? And if and of course there is a dependence on how that what the absolute efficiency is in these two clusters.
Which makes your point stronger, but
all right, I may have lost a factor there, but anyway, that's the argument. Yeah, I mean there's another way of looking at it, which maybe somebody's going to ask about, which is obvious from just the raw images themselves. You've got roughly, if we don't worry about factors of two here, which we clearly shouldn't, because just to remind everyone, this number here alone, the collision factor, is very uncertain for 6297 because the bloody core radius is still so poorly pinned down. Craig Sozin spent, you know, how long I've been trying to measure this. So these are very uncertain numbers, but if you just step back and say, what do we see in these two clusters? We see within factors of two, the same numbers of CVs, 30 versus 10, but we see 100 versus 1 pulsars, right? The masses, of course, are a factor of 5 different. That's the essence of the argument. Yeah.
Josh, for understanding the emission from these BY Draconis, I would think at these X-ray luminosities, they must be very near the turnoff. Can you talk a little bit about what you know about where they are on the main sequence?
Peter showed that, and I purposely left out since... as short in time as it was, the CMDs. But these are typically on the main sequence, well distributed all down the main sequence. There are two, or actually a number now, of interesting exceptions, which are those red straggler systems, which include the pulsar in 6397, and include this virtual twin in its optical properties, and now from the new data, increasingly perhaps its X-ray properties. Those are just below the turnoff, or just to the red of the turnoff. And I don't think any of us understand how they got there or what they're doing there. But at least one of those, the one in 6397 that is the pulsar, has got there by being doubly exchanged in the system. That is almost certainly not the original companion in the system. Whether that's what puts all of them in that position, I don't know.
Other questions?
There was one more argument here that I wanted to touch on, which we now could briefly mention, and that is, it's the point I was just making, in fact, which is in these recent papers we've been writing. 6397 clearly has had this double encounter. There are lots of other cases. I've only written down a couple of immediate ones that come to mind, Craig's argument in 6652 with the QLMXBs well out of the core. A very interesting recent paper, not having to do with what we're talking about at the meeting here, rather having to do with QLMXBs and the spectra just out in the last week or two, but pointing out that this, I didn't write down its telephone number, is out at about the half, roughly half the half mass radius of this cluster, 6293, one that hasn't been on any of our lists. Now, it's not the a priori probability is not zero of putting an LMXB or a QLMXB within, in this case, 7 or 8 arc minutes of the center of this cluster. But given what we're seeing here and in a whole host of other ones, 6397 of these scattering events, I think we have to take now very seriously the notion that these things are being kicked out of clusters. We're going to hear more about this in the extragalactic case. That's, you know, almost certainly what's going on in the ellipticals, but I think we've been seeing this all along in the galaxy. There's this, you know, one of Deepto's favorite objects here, you know, one of the few, the three or the four now, three bona fide millisecond pulsars in X-rays. This is not a radio millisecond pulsar, so don't get confused, which is way out in the halo. And perhaps it's been kicked out of the plane. This is an old problem that we've worried about for years. But if these things are being ejected from clusters, we're probably seeing, you know, the actual LMXBs there as well. And for those who read AstroPH this morning, I couldn't resist putting on something that I would not immediately sign up to. But we can see that a couple of guys here, Felix Mirabel and Rodriguez, have claimed, based on you can read the abstract here, that they've tried to trace the orbit back of this thing. They must be using their VLBA proper motions of SCOEX1, which must have appreciable uncertainties, to say the least. But they, if you can read this, they've argued that this thing is on a high-velocity orbit. So this, of course, is not the kind of LMXB that we've seen in a globular cluster, but that doesn't mean that it's not conceivable. So the whole disruption process was the last, or ejection process, and this was the final chart.
Okay. Walter, do you
want to? Josh, I know you have suggested already quite some time ago that perhaps even all bright low-mass X-ray binaries in our galaxy may have been formed in globular clusters.
Yeah.
I have thought about that a great deal. We've discussed it.
Yep.
The issue that comes up immediately is, of course, the distribution. The distribution of the bright low-mass X-ray binaries outside globular clusters is unlike globular clusters. And I've discussed it today again over lunch with my neighbor here, Andrew.
Yep.
And we feel that there's a major problem. Maybe, yeah, I mean, perhaps a few are, but it is unlikely that that most of them are. Now, I know you have different ideas about that, and I would like to hear those again.
Okay. As we discussed the other day, and actually this is in old papers way back when, the way I think you could make this work with a thick disk, bulge center population is that, A, that's where the globular cluster distribution is peaked on the galactic center, so that the angular offset from the center is not the problem. The problem is, how do you get the flattened thick disk distribution? And there, it's, I think, due to this, what may or may not be a metallicity correlation, which globular clusters have the most neutron stars a priori, and they are primarily the thick disk metal-rich clusters. So you have to take the convolution of two different distributions, the distribution of clusters that have got either the most neutron stars or have been most efficient at retaining them, and the likelihood that not only ejection, but cluster disruption. We know that 6712 is being torn apart. We've heard at the meeting here that, and we've talked about it for years, of course, that the a priori probability of other clusters, or that the initial cluster distribution was much larger in number than today, is significant. So if you combine not only ejection, but disruption with the same parent population, namely a thick disk, I think it can work.
Well, we went over that a little bit quantitatively at lunch, and we can't quite make it to within an order of magnitude or two.
Well, the zeroth order. About
100 low mass X-ray.
There are 100 low mass X-ray binaries. You have, actually, that's another interesting point. From this whole QLMXB business, the numbers now are becoming reasonably clear what the total number of those in the galactic cluster system would be. The correlations that we've seen here with collision rate for the quiescent systems. And the answer is that the total number, adding up all the clusters in the galaxy, just scaling on these usually fairly poorly determined collision rate numbers, the total number is several hundred.
Okay, guys, we're going to need to continue the discussion at the coffee break. It's time to move on. Let's thank Josh again.